This is the SF Signal Podcast, the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal Podcast. I always forget, and then John does not give me my cookie. My name is Patrick Hester. I am your host. I'm also an author, a blogger, a podcast dude, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight, I have a very special episode. The folks over at the Gen Con Writer Symposium asked if I would help promote their little conference that's part of Gen Con this year, and every year, I guess. But they asked me this year if I would help promote it a little bit by doing some interviews, and I, of course, said sure. And they sent me a bunch of people that I could possibly interview, and I picked some, and I said, how about these? And this is one of the folks who came back and said, yes, absolutely, I'd love to do that. Her name is Susan J. Morris. And Susan has a ton of things going on. Susan, why don't you tell people who you are and what you do?
Hey, so I worked as an editor for Wizards of the Coast Forgotten Realms novels line for just over 6 years and have freelanced for them since. I designed D&D for Kids, Heroes of Hesiod, which just had a module come out last week called Champions of the Elements. I published 4 fantasy books and wrote a column on writing for Amazon's blog called Writers Don't Cry, which I love because it's totally true, right?
Like, yeah.
Writers never cry. And I also am a DM for a 5e homebrew campaign that I'm really enjoying at the moment.
So all of that is awesome. And I want to get into every single bit of it. But I want to start with, you mentioned before we started recording that you are moderating 9 panels at Gen Con.
Yes. Yeah. I love moderating panels.
I think there's... I love it. And no one ever invites me to do it.
Oh, you have to volunteer.
I do.
Oh, you do?
I do.
Oh, that's so sad. Yeah, no, I really like it. I think it's, I mean, you should, I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, I love trying to figure out the perfect questions to kind of both open up the most interesting stories from the people on the panel, but also ones that are going to address the concerns of the audience, which is interesting because that means you both want to start, I feel like, very simple with things like, why is this important? Why are we even talking about this subject? To kind of drilling down into the things that the individual authors are kind of experts on.
Yes. And the best panels are the ones where the moderator lets those other panelists, those authors and people who are there to talk, you know, really shine and elevate them and let them, you know, be that focal point for people.
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite changes in the last 2 years. In the last 2 years, moderators have just moderated. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, at Gen Con, moderators were also panelists, and you were basically just elected the moderator if you were the first person on the list.
Oh, wow.
And so it was a fantastic change that Mark made so that now you know if you're moderator ahead of time, because I'm one of those people that wants to research and prepare. Mm-hmm. And I think it just makes it so much smoother when the moderator is not also trying to insert their opinions, but is instead trying to highlight and keep things moving, make sure everyone gets a chance to voice their opinion and things like that.
Yes, exactly. So I always have my little notebook and I have all the people's names on there, and I write down their names, and then as I call on them to answer questions or to give opinions, I put a little mark next to their name so I know who's talked and who still needs to talk.
That's a smart plan.
Yes. It's awesome. So the 9 panels that you're moderating, is that just part of the Writer Symposium or is that part of Gen Con as a whole?
All of those are Writer Symposium panels.
Wow. And what are some of the topics?
So on Thursday, the one I'm most excited about is the very first one I'm doing, which is how to talk about your book. And this is something that I wanted to go to that panel, and I suggested it to Mark last year because I realized that some people are just exceptional at talking about their books. But like for me, if someone asks me about my book and I'm not prepared, I'll be like, it's fantasy. And then I'll either go into like this incredibly long, complicated screed, or like I'll stop there.
Where there's a hero.
Yes. But what I found is that there are some people who are just exceptional at having like one line or 2 lines that like completely captures the theme of their book. And then like a paragraph, if the person still expresses interest in hearing more, and then like 3 paragraphs. And then like they have this system where they like kind of open it up a little by little so that they always have the buy-in of the audience and are never kind of like boring them. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's so smart and so necessary, especially when you're going to be put in all these situations where you suddenly have to talk about your book, and it's important that you be able to do so well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg about talking about your book. I mean, there's so many different times when you have to talk about it.
And it can be interesting because when do you talk about it?
Yes.
Right? It's like, and I took someone to a signing here not too long ago, and she's not used to being around authors. And there was a bunch of us in the back, and we've all known each other. We're all part of the Colorado community, and we've seen each other at all these different events and stuff. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I haven't seen you in forever. And I'm hugging people, and it's like everybody starts talking about what they're working on. It just came out. It's like, oh, I'm working on this. Oh, I'm working on a YA fantasy. Oh, I'm working on a blah, 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 blah. And it's just everybody. And she's just standing there like, wow, you guys are weird. You just, no one even asked. You just started talking about your books. What's up with that?
Yeah, I think that sometimes, I could come up with my explanations, but I totally think that because writers spend so much time alone writing, like, the idea that someone could be, like, I think a lot of people feel the need to express what they're doing. Like, sometimes it's kind of like, I guess this is a dour topic to take it to, but if you've ever had, like, a serious injury or surgery or been sick, and, like, people ask you how you are, and, like, the first thought that comes to mind is always, I'm sick or I'm injured. My entire life is consumed with this injury and has been for the last 6 months. But you don't want to say that, right?
Right.
So I guess a certain degree, it's like, yes, it might be a huge portion of your life, but knowing to mention, oh, I'm working on something and I have a life. Or I don't have a life, but, you know, you're welcome to think that I do.
Well, I should mention before we go any further that the Gen Con runs July 30th through August 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
I think so.
Yeah. And the symposium has been going on there for a while. And I think since the beginning.
This is the 20th year.
Wow, that's crazy. And it's not just sci-fi writers. It's like all kinds of writers.
Oh, yeah. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, romance, all different types, action.
And how many years have you been going?
4 now, I think. Wow. The first year I was just a panelist. And after that, I was like, I would love to moderate because I had such a good time. Because that's back when the panelist, the top one, would moderate. And then they started putting me on moderation. And yeah, I haven't looked back. I really enjoy it.
So who do you think should go?
Oh, to the symposium?
Yeah.
Basically anyone. I mean, I basically hang out the whole time at the symposium going to panels when I'm not on them because I really enjoy, I think that no matter what level, if you're interested in writing or if you're interested in getting a deeper appreciation for books, there's so much for you there. Like, as a beginner writer or as an experienced writer, you're going to learn things. And even just hearing, like, I can't tell you the number of breakthroughs I've made in my own work where I hear someone else's perspective on how they do something, like, even just like a work method. And I'm like, oh, I've never approached things that way. And I try that, and it ends up working beautifully for me. And sometimes it doesn't, but, like, you learn so much in these. And then if you just want to gain a deeper appreciation, like, you get just kind of get a peek behind the scenes. It's almost like, you know, those behind the scenes movie making of the movie.
Sure.
Bits that,
like,
you
the
see.
Extra bits on the DVD.
Hmm?
Like the extra bits on the DVD. Yeah.
And I was going to say, cause like YouTube's where you see most of them these days. Right. But yeah, you get to find out all these, like, how it was made, and you get to hear stories. Like, I remember sometimes authors seem so famous that you figure they must have been born writing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you hear their stories of, like, no, they actually worked at it, and, you know, they got rejected 13 times before their 14th novel made it, and, you know, now they're writing what they love, and it's doing really well. But, like, you get to hear, like, the process, too.
Sure.
There are the people who get published with their very first book and are just amazing, but there are also the people who've worked really hard, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Do you think that fans would enjoy just going and listening to some of this stuff?
Absolutely. There are actually a number of seminars and panels, I think, that are specifically geared toward that. Like, I know there's a night with Patrick Rothfuss, which I think is basically getting to ask him general questions and such. And you can always, there's office hours for the authors, which means that it's fantastic because it means that you can actually go and just chat with one of your favorite authors one-on-one, assuming they're in the office at that time.
Very cool.
And, like, almost every single author is happy to talk to you for a few minutes after their panel, unless they're going directly to a new panel.
Well, and here's another thing. Now, you and I don't know each other very well. We've only just met, but I've heard a rumor. and I don't know if you could substantiate this or not, but there are certain writers that will also sit down and talk to you if you offer to buy them a drink. I've heard that rumor.
So I have also heard that rumor. it turns out. So, yeah, I mean, the authors are a super friendly bunch, and you're going to catch them hanging out. Many authors enjoy the casual drink.
Yes.
So
I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously, don't count on it, but it is certainly something that can happen.
So you've been going for a few years now. Mm-hmm. What sparked your interest originally in the whole thing?
Well, I had been doing this, two things. One, I had been doing this column for Amazon, The Writers Don't Cry, which is, I basically try and break down like tips for getting out of tough writing situations. So I try and always give multiple approaches. Because I mean, like, I think the thing that's hard about writing advice is that it really is different for everyone. There are so many different ways to even think about problems. But like sometimes when you're stuck, it's because you can't see outside the one way in which you're thinking about a problem. And so it's kind of aimed at that. And I happened to have been a Gen Con Industry Insider Guest of Honor that year. And I was doing a bunch of programming for Writers Don't Cry. And then Mark Tassin had asked me if I wanted to come and also be in the symposium, and I was thrilled. I'd always been interested in being on the symposium because I think talking about writing theory, like I almost went to grad school just to talk more about writing theory and to hear more about writing theory and to just discuss it with other people. Like I love writing theory. It's my favorite thing. I could seriously talk about it all day. And so having an opportunity to like discuss it with other people, to hear what other people think about it, to like, I mean, it's fantastic. And also, it's such an amazing social event. Like, I love getting to know all the different authors and, you know, hear their opinions on all kinds of things, but largely writing theory and books.
Well, it can be, from the fan's perspective, it can be thrilling, really thrilling, to meet that favorite author and be able to chat with them, especially ask them a question. I'm sure there are listeners out there who would love to sit down and ask Patrick Rothfuss some questions.
Oh, yeah.
From the author's perspective, I've gone to Pikes Peak Writers now for a couple of years, and there's always this energy.
Mm.
And when you're around other writers and other creative types, you know, it's like everybody feeds off everybody else. And before you know it, you're full. And you just have all this creative energy that you want to expel.
Yeah.
And it's like a boost for you. And you talk about like a lot of the walls that you put up and problems that you kind of create for yourself. You go to one of these things and you talk to all these other authors, you find out they have the same issues you have. Mm-hmm. And before you know it, you're just sitting there raring to go and you can't wait to sit down and write.
Yeah, that's the best.
That is the best. So let's talk about some of this other stuff that you mentioned, you know, Wizards of the Coast.
Oh yeah.
So Forgotten Realms, have you ever heard of that Greenwood guy?
Yeah, he was one of my authors for a long time. Also, you know, creator of
the
Realms like 50 years ago. Isn't that crazy? I can't believe it's been that long. That's,
I know,
like,
right?
Yeah.
And he created it was basically, wasn't he? I've had him on. It was years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He created it as a setting and was using like doing games
as a 6-year-old kid. Well, yeah. He created it originally like before D&D was created, because he wanted a place to tell his own stories. He talks about it in, he has a, oh, what is that called? He has a, there's an, a book, that we released about Elminster. That's basically a collection of his three first Elminster books. Mm. And has a pipe on the cover and it's really pretty and everything. But it also has essays talking about like how he started the realms and like what the realms means to him and what makes something intrinsically realmsy and things like that. And I thought the essays were like, it was truly excellent. But yeah, so he started it because he was reading, apparently he really liked reading Shakespeare and everything, which will come as no surprise to people who are familiar with his early work. And so he came up with the world so he could write his own stories. And then when D&D came out, he was like, oh, this is cool. And made it into a setting and started using it for his games and submitting the setting to Dragon.
That's awesome. So what's involved in being an editor for the Forgotten Realms?
So there are a lot of different types of editors, but I worked as a I guess it's kind of, at Wizards of the Coast, everything was kind of a combo editor. So I was an acquiring, but I was also a developmental. But acquiring is a little different because basically when you're working a line like that, you kind of decide, like, we have this many books and we're exploring these areas and we have these authors. And like, I would like, there's a couple ways to do it. If you have an author you really like, then, you know, you see if they have a pitch for you. Or if you want to try someone new or something, then you would come up with an idea for what kind of, like for instance, we did the Fighter series and the Wizard series, and in which there were four books by four new authors, each of which was centered on a different type of wizard or fighter or thief. You know, we did one for each class.
Sure.
And so then you have, we'd have people do pitches, and, you know, we had done that Maiden of Pain pitch a while ago, which got us a huge pool. And so a lot of times it was limited pitches to people that we were interested in, but didn't have slots for. But the day-to-day wasn't actually acquiring. The day-to-day was more developmental, which is my favorite part. And that's where you basically try and help them with, make their book the book it's supposed to be. I don't think of it in terms of, a lot of people I think that editors kind of like tell their authors what to do, but it's really not like that. It's very much more like, you see what they're trying to do, where the arcs are, and you try and, or where are, but then you also see where arcs are missing or broken and where you can kind of like help them pull that book to the highest level it can be.
In chapter 1, you cut off this guy's hand, and then in chapter 27, he uses that hand to draw his sword.
There's that too, right? There's also the logic and continuity. So a huge part of being an editor for Forgotten Realms is not only in the same book continuity, and usually there wasn't hand things. Usually it was more like the eye color changing or the favorite dish or something. But there's also like, there's over 200 books, and that's just books of Forgotten Realms lore and everything. And then there's also all the articles in Dragon and all the online stuff. Like, there's so much information. It's kind of like doing historical fiction because you have to do so much research.
So I'm assuming that there's a Bible.
For the Forgotten Realms?
Yes.
It's mostly there is a editing Bible, but most of the Bible in terms of like world information is actually that history of like 200 books. Because you've got like the world books, the campaign settings and everything, which give you some. But then also throughout edition changes, there's a lot of like figuring out how you're going to handle the sudden changes. Like when succubuses switched sides and suddenly became devils instead of demons. Or when angels lost their legs and mouths. Or when elves, like, eyes went solid, right? And they lost, like, the whites and pupils.
Mm.
So it's, like, figuring out, like, what is the story reason for this happening? And so that's going to be written down somewhere and kept. But the actual facts of what it's like now are going to be in that campaign setting.
Without naming names, did you ever have to tell someone, you can't do this because it's not D&D. It's not Forgotten Realms.
Well, yeah. I mean, most of the time, it does happen. Like, most of the time, it's not a, you can't do this. Most of the time, it's a, here are other ways in which you could make the same thing happen. But the thing is, writers are excellent when they're writing the realms at understanding where the hard rules are, because there's an actual rule set, right?
Sure.
So fortunately, everyone's really, that's like, I think the most understanding, authors are most understanding about taking, like, there is a rule against this. It's hardest when you have to tell an author something, like if a plot point isn't working for you.
Mm.
That's much harder, because then you have to figure out, you know, it's very hard to you're helping try and make it a better book, but it can sometimes feel, I mean, I'm an author too, so I know it can sometimes feel not great when someone tells you what you need to fix. So
sometimes readers have issues with tie-in novels.
Oh yeah.
Do you have your recommendation? This is the book, or these are the books that you absolutely should give a shot.
So I really do think that depends on what kinds of books you like to read.
Okay.
Because like, there at this point, the Forgotten Realms is down to authors that are all really pretty polished. But for instance, if you like kind of dark, gritty fiction, then read Paul Kemp's books about Erebus Kale. If you like, I think that Erin M. Evans does a fantastic job with epic fantasy. Her Fire in the Blood was a political fantasy. I edit her as well. And so I think she's great for people who are fans of like any type, like Game of Thrones or any kind of political fantasy.
Okay.
Of course, I mean, R.A. Salvatore, I think, is escapes the shared world net because he has so many fans from mainstream.
Okay.
So, he's obviously a good one there.
The Demon Wakes. I think it's called The Demon Wakes.
For which one?
I think that was like that was a title of one of his, The Demon Wakes or The Demon Awakens or something like that. I remember that book. I still have it on my shelf somewhere.
Oh, maybe. I don't remember that one. Is that one of his non-Forgotten Realms?
I thought it was Forgotten Realms.
Interesting. Recently, I'm going to look up his books real quick. I have all his books on my website.
Really?
Yes, I run the Metatext, which is a fan newsletter for books, which basically just tells you all the information that's coming out. Like if there were interviews with authors recently released that are Forgotten Realms authors and like, you know, if the authors have posted cool things on their blog.
Well, I've also gotten to chat with him and he was a lot of fun to talk to.
He's amazing. Yeah. And his books are excellent, but I'm figuring that most people are not avoiding him because of the shared world thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just because he's so well known outside of shared world. Like he's a New York Times bestselling author like every time.
Oh yeah, that doesn't surprise me. The Demon Awakens, the Demon Wars saga. Maybe it
Demon
is
Wars outside. Is his. Yeah, that's yeah, not that's Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, that's not Forgotten Realms. You're
yeah,
right.
But yeah, I've heard really good things about it, though. But he's an excellent author. And so I guess he's actually probably the easiest. If you haven't tried any Forgotten Realms novels and you haven't tried Salvatore, Salvatore is probably who you should start with. But I really highly recommend checking out the current lineup and seeing which of them works really well for you, because I mean, like, and then Troy Denning, who's done a bunch of Star Wars novels, New York Times bestselling, also, he's writing in the realms right now, and he has a very heroic style. So if you really like kind of more positive heroic fiction, he's a good one to check out. So there's so many different types.
How long have you been in the Dungeons and Dragons world?
You mean as a fan or as
complete total?
A really long time.
Okay.
Like it started, I mean, I couldn't spell yet. I was a kid. And I was backseat gaming when my dad was playing nice. Eye of the Beholder, which I had no idea was actually a like Forgotten Realms game. and then because I was backseat gaming so much, he eventually got me my own to play. And then I ended up doing the Forgotten Realms Unlimited Adventures and made dungeons for all my friends, like you do.
Yes, absolutely.
And then I started gaming, like, you know, because like I got into gaming through both the computer side and then like reading the Monster Manual, which I was obsessed with monsters, which you can probably still tell because of like my Practical Guide series are basically like odes to Monster Manuals. And I just loved reading. It was the Monstrous Manual at that time, second edition. And I just loved reading about all the cultural details of all the monsters. It's the part everyone hates.
I'm trying to see what.
But I just love it. I love it.
I actually have one of the Monster Manuals that came in a big white box,
mm-hmm,
with a binder and everything. It's over on the shelf actually opposite me, but it's angled in such a way that I can't see the spine. So I don't know what edition it is, but it's pretty old.
Monster's Manual had a black spine, I believe.
This was a white book.
I have to look it up now. I'm really sad. I don't have my old Monster's Manual anymore. Because like when I was young, I was innocent. And I thought that when 3 and 3.5 came out, that those were the final edition and that I should just buy them.
This was a special thing. It's in a white box. And the binder slides in. And it's actually, it's like a 3-ring binder where you can add pages.
Is that must be more like first, at least.
Don't know. Could be. Like or I said, I can't like, see it from here, dang it.
I'm looking up the different Monsters manuals online.
I just had Dave Gross on. And we were talking about the red box and you know what that meant to us. And you know, even as you move forward into Pathfinder, like they've got their beginner's box that is such a throwback to that red box. It was a nice nostalgia piece.
Yeah.
And so you've been gaming though since you were a kid. You started out with this. So did you ever think that you would be working for Wizards of the Coast and doing like official Dungeons and Dragons stuff?
No. I kind of decided I wanted to do that when I was in college, but like before that point, like, it's so funny because like I've met some of the people now who I grew up reading and like idolizing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just you just never think that you'd be able to go there, right? Because it's something that seems so out there, but I always enjoyed creating, right? So I guess that's a sign that it can happen. Like, I always like to be the DM. I always like to design the dungeons and the games with Forgotten Realms and Limited Adventures, which is awesome. Someone needs to update it. Modern graphics.
So you, what made you decide to create like Dungeons and Dragons for kids?
So a couple things. One is that I had started running kind of pickup games at a local game store. And of course, like when you start doing that, when like parents figure this out, they realize that it's basically free babysitting. So you end up getting a lot of kids while their parents are shopping.
I had that happen to me with Magic the Gathering too.
Yeah.
It's like all of a sudden there's all these kids and you're going, why are all these kids here? Where are their parents? Oh, they left.
And okay.
I was like, okay.
Yeah, they're great though. And like, I had a really interesting time trying to figure out like how to design, because I would design my own things for that too. And kind of like how to design things that would engage the kids and that would kind of, that's kind of where I started my idea of corrective, like teaching the correct, quote unquote, correct way to game or proper gaming practices through in-game rewards and effects and causation and all that. Like, because with kids, like you don't want to sit and lecture them when they are doing things. Like one kid, like when they're doing things that aren't productive or outside the plot, you never want to do that. Like you want to come up with ways to kind of get them naturally to do the things that are like good gaming practices, like working together rather than sabotaging each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so like,
yeah, the sabotaging comes later.
Yes. But especially like they'll never get anywhere if everyone's just always stabbing each other in the back.
Right.
And so like, for instance, for that one, I ended up doing, there was like a competitive dungeon maze where, they had entered against these other NPC parties, and basically the first person to get to the center, won, but there were all these monsters along the way. And then there were also optional obstacles that had like, you can open the door, there's a treasure chest in there, but there's also a monster. And so you kind of had to decide as a group which way you were going and how you were going to solve the different puzzles and traps and how you were going to get past, like whether you were going to engage with these creatures. And so it was interesting because like basically when they started sabotaging each other, they started falling behind. And this motivated them right away to no longer fall behind. And they actually started working together. And it was fantastic to see. But then like with some of the younger kids, I was really captured by the idea of trying to basically break down the rules into a system of like small play encounters that teach you the basics of D&D. And so like, cause like if you play a video game these days, like you don't sit and read a rule book, right?
No,
you play mini games, if anything, in order, like you have a playable game bit that kind of shows you how to play.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And so I was like, how would I break this down to like its basic form while retaining the spirit of D&D? And so I took the combat system first because I honestly think combat is the best thing to start with new players. Even when I have adults, I start with combat in the first session, mainly because it's something concrete that has concrete rules that they can figure out what to do. A lot of new players have trouble with the social stuff because it's so intimidating and they can get kind of overrun by right. yeah. more experienced players.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you're all in the tavern. Start talking.
And like, And like traps and crafts, traps and riddles and all this other kind of like creative stuff can be also super intimidating. Anything free form is more intimidating. And there's free form in fighting, but you don't have to do it in order to enjoy fighting. So I decided to start with the combat system. And the idea was eventually going to be to do like a series of three different, like there's the social one and like the one with so like a social mini game, and like that was the fighter mini game, and then also doing one for like objects and crafts and things like that. And so by playing all of these, you would kind of learn the system, and then you could put them together and get like a simplified actual full game system.
That's awesome.
Thanks.
It is. It's totally awesome. You know, just last Saturday, I played Dungeons & Dragons for the first time in a very long time. And I was having to get back into it. And you were talking about stabbing each other in the back, and that's what brought this to mind. There was a point where the other character, when another character did something that I didn't like, and so I looked at the game master, or the dungeon master, and I pointed at the other character, and I said, "Can I fight him?" And he's like, well... And it was essentially, he was a paladin, and someone surrendered to him. And now he had to protect that someone, and that someone was someone I wanted to kill. I'm like, so if I go after this guy, do I get to fight him? And the Dungeon Master's sitting there kind of like, huh. And the paladin, who I'm a barbarian, and the paladin's going, I don't want to fight him, but I can't let him kill the guy who surrendered. So I totally threw a wrench and everything. I'm like, I'm ready, because I want this guy dead. So if I attack this guy and he starts defending him, I'm fighting him. I'm sorry. Just yeah. So woohoo.
No, I love that kind of stuff, as long as it's not like that's the thing. I was actually thinking about player types and everything the other day for like building the perfect perfect party. And I do think that the player who's going to kind of throw the wrench in or go the not normal route is always good to have in your party. What you don't want is a group of people who are all doing that all the time.
Right.
Because then you never get plot, and then the people who are plot monkeys never get happy.
Right. Exactly.
Well, it's great. We have one of those in our game, and it's fantastic. I always giggle when the other players realize what he was up to. It's some of the best plot twists come from that.
It can be, yes. Well, I always wonder how to introduce kids to gaming like this, because it's like, what age really, you know? And I remember the Red Box, but if they're a little bit younger, like you know, you were trying to play essentially when your dad was doing stuff.
Oh yeah.
So it's nice to be able to have that element for the younger kids that they can get them into it and get them in quickly. And then, if you know, eventually they're going to graduate to the regular game.
Yeah. And like, I think the thing that I also really wanted was something where like you're alone in the summer with your sister and you really want to play, but you don't know anyone who plays. So like, what can you do? Which is why we made it print, like a printout. So you can actually just like print it out and play from there and cut it out, because it's and free. Because like, I feel for those kids who are at home with no other options and they really want to play a game.
Right.
Like that. So yeah, this game has been played, it's 4-6 and up, but kids as young as 6 have run it and kids as young as 4 have played it.
Wow.
And it's actually, I think, does best without too much adult intervention. Like, I know a lot of people assume that it's meant for adults to kind of be running for them, and like, you can run it, but like, I saw most kids blossom when their parents were kind of looking the other way.
It's freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're no longer being judged.
Because it's kind of a violent game.
Sure.
Like, I made the new one a lot less violent, mainly because the art is so freaking cute that like some kids were like, I want to adopt it. If you want to adopt the beholder. Yes! And so like, of course, on the fly, just change that to be you're trying to like subdue it so that you can train it and ride it around like a pony. your own personal beholder. But like, I made this one a little less, you're still defeating them, but I say defeat so that you can kind of come up with your own way to swing it there. You can still kill them if you really want to.
Here's what's awesome. A really good friend of mine, he has two boys, and his sister has a daughter, and his brother has a boy, and all of these kids have grown up with us playing World of Warcraft. And so when they couldn't type because they were not yet in school, they weren't writing, they were playing World of Warcraft, all of these children, all these kids. And I'll tell you what, my friend's oldest boy, he used to piss me off because he was better at PvP than I was.
That's the worst.
And everybody thought he was a Chinese gold farmer. because he never typed anything, right? He couldn't speak to you. He couldn't talk to you on the keyboard because he's a kid. He doesn't have those skills. So what would happen is, you know, he would play and he would join pugs and but people would think that he was a Chinese gold farmer just there, you know, and not talking. And then his mom would have to go on there and say, oh, you know, he's only five. And then people are going, what? He's so good.
That moment when you realize the five-year-old is better than you.
Yes. And now I'm thinking all of these kids, we've talked about, you know, playing Dungeons and Dragons with them or trying to get them to play. And now I'm looking at this going, I got to get this. I got to print this out. I got to give it to these kids and get them playing. They will love it. They will absolutely love it. They will.
Thank you. You should also consider the No Thank You Evil game that Shauna and Monty Cook Games have put out. It just funded on Kickstarter, and it looks amazing. And that's a system where you can make your own games for kids.
Oh, that's awesome.
Play tested around the world. And, I mean, I actually contributed to the Kickstarter. I really, really would love to play that game as well. And that's a great way. I don't know if you know the cipher system that they use for their games for like The Strange and everything. Oh, it's actually really fun. In my homebrew, I adapt a couple of their rules into 5e just because I like them so much.
So you have to explain to me, what does it mean to be a DM 5th edition homebrew?
So I think homebrew kind of technically only refers to the world. However, I'm one of those people that like I will design the game that feels the best to me. So like I will have... It's mostly 5th edition, but there's a couple rules that I don't play with, and there's a couple rules I import from previous editions. And then I have my own sections. Like, I invented a system for alchemy and things like that. And then also, like, for this, like, I'm absorbing a couple rules from the cipher system because I really like them. And I do a lot of my own design work in terms of, like, the monsters or the villains they fight and random, like... If I want to have a non-combat encounter, I often create the mechanics for that too.
Now, here's where I'm gonna throw you a gotcha question. Are you playing 5th edition because you're toeing the party line?
No, I actually really like 5th edition. I started 5th edition because I haven't worked in-house for Wizards for years, so I started 5th edition just because D&D's always been kind of my main game. Like, I've played a lot of other game systems over the years. Like, I mean, college was all White Wolf, let's be honest. There's something about D&D that I'm so familiar with it, I think, that it just makes it really easy to know how I want to run my game.
Okay. That makes sense.
And so, like, we started in the playtest. And that was exciting, except for the fact that I had to read new rule books all the time. That was less exciting. I think the best thing about D&D, it always kind of fascinated me when people don't change the rules to make them the way they like. Like, I love a lot of things because they brought back a lot of what I liked about like 2nd edition and 3rd edition in 5th while retaining some of the things I liked about 4th edition. So I thought that was really awesome. Of course, there's going to be things that they did that I don't like, but there's always going to be some way that I'll just change it to be the way I like it, right? So.
Yeah. Well, I just recently, I played for the first time the Dresden Files role-playing game.
Oh, cool.
Which uses the Fate system. And
yeah, I've heard a lot about the Fate system. It's
really
that. Fun.
I liked that because it was it's essentially plus, minus, or nothing.
Yeah.
And that's so simple.
Yeah, I bet that would work really well for kids.
Yeah, exactly. And supposedly you can use that, you know, to create whatever kind of games you want, hint hint. I know you're not busy. I mean, come on.
Oh, no, no. Yeah, it's yeah, it's interesting. I think I do kind of like, when it comes to adult games, I do kind of like the complexity simply because one of the things I ran into when doing the games for kids is like, there's kind of like a sweet spot for probability for the players to feel like they're having a good time. Mm-hmm. Like, they feel like it's fair if they hit about like 80% of the time or maybe even 85. Like, it doesn't feel fair if they hit less than that, even though that's clearly... you know, nowhere close to fair. And one of the things when I found when I was like adjusting, because like in the D&D for kids, I did it so that you could do it with 3d6s instead of a d20 if you wanted, because so many families are not going to have a d20. Like,
right.
Mine didn't,
yeah.
Right? My parents were very gamer because in terms of video games and console games and everything, but not paper games. So, but I found that it really does change kind of the probability curve. And one of the best things about having like a D20 and everything is that it has, I mean, a really nice probability curve that you can play with.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And have I love multiple layers of everything. So like if there's information, I want to have like multiple levels of information and disinformation you can get. And like, you know, for like any given thing. And like if you take a random intoxicant, like there should be bad things that can happen to you, neutral things, and then good things, right?
Yeah.
Like I like it being everything should matter. Like everything you do should have a consequence, right? So gives me more freedom for that.
Now, how do you react as a dungeon master, you know, personally? How do you react when you have spent, you know, a lot of time putting together a campaign and planning some stuff out, and on just the random roll of the die, someone gets stupid lucky and crits and just clobbers whatever it is you put in their path, and now you're sitting there going, crap.
Well, actually, one of the things I try and design, and this is why I think I could never publish my games, is that I always design kind of in a branching method so that everything, it's not so much that there's a plot so much as it's like a interactive setting that reacts, that has all these ways that it would react.
Choose your own adventure.
Kind of, but more branchy, right? It's like these things have these attributes, which means they react in these ways. So I have ideas that it could branch, but like the players are never going to follow a narrow path. And it's also, it's kind of based on the sandbox game policy. I mean, I'm a huge, huge fan of the Elder Scrolls games. Like,
oh, yeah.
Huge nerd.
There is a problem though with Skyrim,
mm-hmm.
And that's that. Once I got a horse, I thought, "What you always think? I'm going to go fill out my map."
Yes.
And then you start riding along, and those stupid freaking vampires came down and killed my damn horse.
Oh no!
That pissed me off.
I did not have that problem. But I guess did you play with all the expansions on?
No.
Okay. I'm wondering, because, like, I know the vampire thing happened. But, yeah, the horses are, like, permanent, like, monster food. And they, like, run up to attack things, like, up the sides of buildings and everything.
Yes.
Yeah, they're not the smartest.
No.
Get the assassin horse. It doesn't die. And it's really strong. It can practically solo a dragon.
Well, here's what's funny. I realized that I hadn't saved the game.
Oh, no.
So I was like, oh, no, this was good. Because it meant I could go back and still have my horse.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant you hadn't saved the game since when you got the horse.
No. So I'd gotten the horse. So I was like, oh, wait a minute. I haven't saved the game. Ha ha. And so I start over and I go back. I'm like, yes, I've got my horse. I won't go that way. I'm going to go a different way, stupid vampires. And so I went a different way, and then something else came out and killed my horse.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn it.
Yeah. Horses are fragile things. You can actually, even though I think there's like an armored horse mod that you can download that makes your horse like hard to kill. I literally just went straight for the assassin horse. So it was not a problem for me because that thing's undead. But
yes, but the sandbox thing is good. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, sandbox with a pull through, right? Because like the other thing is if you need something to edge, you always need to have something if your players aren't finding threads that they want to do, and you never want it to get boring, right?
Sure.
But you also need to have like one of the best things about designing your own games is that what I do is I have major arcs, and I have three major arcs, and they're ones that are going over years. And then you have minor arcs that go like nine games. And then you have like the short arcs that go three games. And so you plan three games that build into nine games that build into the year long ones. And so the idea is that though, like I have loose ideas about the longer ones, tighter ideas about all the way down to like the three games. And the three games are all written out. But after every game session, I'll sit there and I'll readjust and tighten in order to make it adjust to what would be cool based on what happened. Like I don't feel any attachment to sticking to the plan per se if I come up with something better.
Gotcha.
And I love that. I love the fact that you can just sit there and be like, you know what? It would be so cool now that these players did this thing in this game. It would be so resonant if I could bring that as a callback and make it actually super important. You know?
Yes. So I'm totally running out of time, Susan, and I wanted to at least let you talk about your own fiction for a second, because you do have some books out there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've done four fantasy books, and three of them are practical guides, and they're practical guides to fantastical things. So like a practical guide to fairies, a practical guide to wizardry, and a practical guide to dragon magic. And those are, I really like those because it's kind of like, you know, like the Audubon book for birds, only for things like dragons. And it's very, I tried to make them very kind of interactive. So you're not only like, you know, for like, they're for kids. So it's like for kids learning all these different facts and everything. But it's also like in the wizardry one, there's, it breaks down like the grammar of spells. And there's a chart for like, that's a logic puzzle about creating potions. And there's something that breaks down like, you know, the hand motions you use. And like, there's all kinds of quizzes for like figuring out what familiar you would have and things like that.
I would have a cat.
Yeah, it's funny because there are some kids who will like specifically go to try and get the one answer that they know they want instead of just being like, this is my familiar. well, and there's like,
I have a familiar.
Oh, you have, yeah, one. Oh, so you already have a cat.
Yeah,
it's not that
cat.
It would be, it's that it is.
Yeah, I basically, the entire purpose of my existence is to clean his shitter and give him food.
Mine is for pets. She's on my lap right now.
I am allowed to pet him occasionally.
Mine's, she's a very dog-like cat. She'll run to greet you when you come home. She'll like follow you around and sit next to you and just chill.
When I get home, Shadow the cat is standing in the kitchen. His tail is up in the air and he's screaming at me, "Where the hell have you been?"
Demanding.
Yeah. There
Imperial.
He is. There is a hole in my dish. Never mind that there's food all the way up to the rim, all the way around it. There's a little hole in the center.
That's unacceptable. Like, what are you thinking?
Yes.
The standards in this place.
So, Susan, you wanna finish your thought?
Oh, yeah. No, just that I also did a... I did The Fairy Locket, which is a companion to The Practical Guide to Fairies, but it's a novel. And that was a lot of fun also.
That's awesome. So what's next for Susan?
Currently, I've been working on some sci-fi horror, which is not for kids.
Okay.
And I'm also writing about DMing on my blog at susanjmorris.com. And it sounds like people have been having a good reaction to the D&D for kids, so I might be doing more of that.
That's awesome. Yeah, so you gave us your website. Do you do social media?
I'm on Twitter.
I know. That was actually a loaded question. I follow you on Twitter.
Aw, I follow you too.
So what's your Twitter handle?
Susan J. Morris. Try and keep it simple.
That is simple, yeah. And obviously you're going to be at Gen Con at the Writer's Symposium. Any other con appearances or places where people can go and say hello?
I'll be at Worldcon this year.
I will be at Worldcon.
Oh, hey, that'll be awesome. We
in
should catch
fact,
up.
In fact, Worldcon is in your backyard.
I know. That's why I'm so excited. I can drive.
And I don't know if you're aware of this. If you're looking for the rain that normally falls there, apparently we got it here in Denver.
Oh, no.
So feel free to take that back.
I could use some. My garden needs water.
My goodness. It's been
watering,
insane.
And I really don't want to have to get out there with the hose.
It's been crazy here. Crazy with the rain.
Wow.
And I know the people in California are going, shut up.
I know.
Just shut up.
Seattle really won the lottery in weather.
You did, yeah. And here lately, we have, we usually have like 350 days of sunshine in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And of those 350 days of sunshine, we usually have three, maybe four, where everything's green.
Man.
Yeah. So I worked for a company that did marketing for realtors. And one of the things that we wanted to do was be able to provide them with photographs of the Denver area that they could put on their websites and blogs.
You have to do it
like
4 days of the year.
Yeah. So basically I would tell my photographer, I'm like, go out and get some pictures. I can't. Why not? Everything's brown. Damn it. We missed the window. It was only yesterday.
That's so weird. Yeah, that's one thing I mean, Emerald City for a reason, right? Like, we get the constant mizzle, but...
There's
it's so green. Everything's green.
There's a very famous stock photography image of like downtown Denver with City Park. And it's taken from the Denver Museum of Science and Nature. And you see the little water and you see the city park and you see the skyline and then the mountains in the background. It's a very pretty picture. It's in every stock photography library imaginable. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it closely, you can tell they totally photoshopped the grass.
No.
Yes.
False advertising right there.
Well, Susan, this has been so much fun. I could talk to you forever.
Yes, absolutely.
And I hope that you will let me come say hello to you at WorldCon.
Oh, I think that'd be fun. We'll catch a drink.
I will be there, and I'm gonna have so much fun because I didn't get to go last year, so I've like stored up a whole year's worth of wanting to go to WorldCon.
This is my first year. I'm so excited.
We're gonna make it special.
Awesome.
You're gonna if there's anybody you don't know that I know, you're totally getting introduced.
Everybody,
we're gonna make this happen. This is gonna be because my first WorldCon was absolutely wonderful, and it was because wonderful people like Jay Lake and John DiNardo and all these other people, Kate Baker from Clark's World, mm-hmm. and Neil Clark, they all made it so special because they were so warm and welcoming and inviting. And just introduce me to everybody. So we're totally going to do that. You're going to have the best WorldCon ever.
Thank you so much.
So follow,
I really appreciate that.
Follow Susan online. Check her out on Twitter. Check out her website. Definitely go check out the D&D for Kids and all her books and stuff like that. Susan, thanks for coming on tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast. Your host is Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. His website is www.atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain. ATFMB is also his Twitter handle and where you can find him on Facebook. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the links to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com or search SF Signal in iTunes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and have them tell their friends and so on and so on. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all of your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melds featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SF&F field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, fiction deals, movie reviews, videos, links and roundup posts, and more. Click the RSS button in the sidebar of your browser to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
It's like talking to a child.
Magic woo-wee.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
I don't even know what the horseman is.
And scene, you bastard.